This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
This is really the second in a series of Shiurim in the Republic, of the third next week. Last week we spoke about the relationship between quantity and quality, and the use of quantity as the provision and a framework for quality, which quality can develop. As a result of last week's, I was asked the following question. We mentioned that there is a tendency today to measure everything in terms of quantity. The tendency is not even to look or to examine the quality, but merely to measure in terms of quantity. And we had an example of that last night, when we talked about the fact that although the Dor, the generation of David HaMelech, were very learned people, even the little children were learned, they held them in yeshiva for many years, and they were all very, very meticulous in their observance of the requirements of halakha, of Jewish law. Nevertheless, in terms of quality, they were far below the level of the generation of Achaz, who used to be idol worshippers and didn't keep anything, yet as far as stature was concerned, as far as quality was concerned, they were much higher. So somebody asked us as a result of last week's share that it's understandable why the tendency is to measure in terms of quantity. If I want to know how frum a person is, how can I measure except by how many mitzvahs he does? What other way is there of measuring? How, in fact, can one measure quality? This was the question that was put as a result of last week, which is a very important question. How does one measure quantity? Quantity is designed to be measured. That's what quantity is all about. But quality, which is what life is all about, it's difficult to measure. How do you decide whether somebody is great or isn't great, whether he has quality or doesn't have quality? So this sedra, luckily, is exactly the place I would in any case have gone to look to see. Because we talk in this sedra about the appointment of a Kohen Gadol, a great Kohen. Greatness is quality. So let's see how we measure that quality, how we decide who's a Kohen Gadol. It says, "Now Kohen Agadol Me'echav," and the Kohen is greater than his brothers, etc., who's anointed as the Kohen Gadol, etc., etc., has various dinim in addition to the dinim that apply to a regular Kohen. And the Gemara in Yuna, Daf Yud Ches, brings a brisa. The brisa says the following: "A Kohen Agadol Me'echav, a Kohen who's greater than his brothers," says the brisa. And now imagine when I found this brisa, imagine my excitement, I'm about to hear how you measure a Kohen Gadol. It will answer all the problems, because this problem of measuring Gedula, of measuring Godless, is a very important problem. Says the Brisa, what does that mean? Sheyehe Gadol Me'echov, he has to be greater than his brothers in the following attributes. Koach, he has to be stronger than his brothers. Noi, he has to have more chayim, more personality than his brothers. Chochmeh, he must be wiser than his brothers. Osher, he must be richer than his brothers. The Kohen Gadol. Not a word about Yerushalayim, not a word about character, not a word about integrity, nothing. All he has to be is stronger, he has to have more brawn, noi, more chen, more personality, chokhmah, wisdom, which is also quantitative. Chokhmah is not qualitative, chokhmah is quantitative, and osher, well, Acherim Omrim, others says, Minayim Shim Enlo, She'echov Akoinim Megadlim Oso. And from where do we know that if he doesn't have these attributes, the brothers of the other Koanim actually give him these attributes? Talmud Lomah Ba'akoin, Agodol Me'echov. The Koan who is greater than his brothers, Gadlehu Mishol Echov. You must make him greater, the brothers must make him greater if necessary. And the Sifra actually tells a story where a certain Rapinchas was appointed a Kohen Gadol. And the committee who appointed him started a Senate investigation into his affairs just before he took office. And they followed him around, and they found he was digging pits to earn a bit of a living. So immediately they instructed that the pit should be filled with gold. That's it. Strange business. But now imagine my disappointment. The measurement of the stature of the Kohen Gadol is given by the Gemara in quantitative terms. There's nothing qualitative about how to measure the Kohen Gadol. There are similar attributes given to other requirements. For example, the requirements of a person on whom the Shekhinah falls, a person who has a very personal relationship with Ribbono Shel Olam, similar qualities are given. In the Gemara in Sanhedrin on Daf Yud Zayin, the Gemara goes into the qualities required by members of the Sanhedrin. Who do you appoint on the Sanhedrin? And these same qualities are given. He has to have these qualities, as well as an additional quality which the Gemara describes as Shiur Koma. Shiur Koma can be translated either as height or as stature. But seeing as these are quantitative, it would appear that the other one too, the Shiur Koma, is also quantitative. He has to be tall. And Rashi in fact says that the reason for this is that they should be able to scare the community. The community should be scared of them. Because if the community is not scared of them, they can't give effect, they lose a certain effectiveness in their handling of the community. So it seems that it's really brute wealth and strength and stature that is required in order to make this leader effective. And there are in fact other cases where Shiur Koma is used, where this concept of height is used. We have, for example, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah says that that Moshe Rabbeinu was 10 amas high. How much is 10 amas?
That's 5 meters.
According to the Chazanish?
No.
5 meters, no? What's that in feet?
15
feet. 15 feet tall. The fact that the Gemara reports to us that he was 15 feet tall obviously means that it's important. It's something that we need to know. We've had other examples of Adam HaRishon, where the Gemara says about Adam HaRishon, not only was he tall, the Gemara says the following. Omar Rabbi Elozo, said Rabbi Elozo, remember him? Remember Rabbi Elozo? Same one. Adam HaRishon min ha'oret ad la'rakia. He was from the ground to the sky. He was a giant brother. His head was in the clouds, literally. Shinemar brings a proof. Vekivan shesarach, and after he made a mistake and he ate the fruit, he niach the Rish Baruch Yodov alav umiyato. Ribbono Shel Olam put his hand on Adam and reduced him in size. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav. Rav Yehuda says in the name of Rav, Adam HaRishon misofa olam bat sofa hoyo. Adam HaRishon was from one end of the world to the other, which almost implies that he was as tall as from here to the sky and as broad as from one end to the other. So he was pretty big. One has to understand what this is all about. What significance is it if they are tall? What significance is it in these attributes here that we talked about? And how one understands it all together. The Sifra also is difficult to understand from another point of view. The story that the Sifra brings about filling his pit up with gold. Because what does the Mishnah say? Ezehu Ashir, who is a rich person? Asamash Kachalko. We define wealth in terms of ability to enjoy and be happy with what you've got. The fact that you actually have to quantitatively give him gold to make him rich is something which seems to go against that Mishnah. And yet it seems that it is taken literally, because there's another Gemara where the Gemara learns quite clearly that the requirement of wealth for a Kohen Gadol is literal wealth. There's no question about it. You can't learn other things into it. Now I think the following. There's no question that when we talk of a Kohen Gadol, we're not talking of a strong, fat guy full of personality and wealth. And that's not our concept of what the Kohen Gadol is. And when we use the word Gadol, when we use the word great, that's not what we're talking about in terms of greatness. So what's it all about? Imagine Rembrandt was asked to paint a picture of a Gadol. How would he do it? This is how he would do it. He would paint a person who is powerful. You would see power in the painting. You would see personality in the painting. You would see an aura. You would see wisdom on the face. See, it's an intelligent face, not the face of an imbecile. and wealth. You would see from these, the clothing and the backdrops and the surroundings of the picture in which it's painted and the room in which it's painted, you would see wealth. That's how you paint the picture of godliness. That's how you paint the picture of greatness. And probably Shir Kohen as well, he would probably be tall as well. The Gemara, the Braisa over here, the same applies to the Sifra. I mentioned to some people earlier this afternoon that there are some statements of Torah which have to be taken absolutely literally, and there are some statements which have to be taken artistically. That means that the concept which the Medrash or the Gemara is teaching is a true concept which has to be understood, but the picture that it's painting is not necessarily a photographic picture. The same as a painter will do. The painter will sometimes paint something which never happened, or paint something which doesn't really exist, in order to give a feeling and to give an understanding of a feeling which does exist and of an experience which does exist. It seems clear here that when the Gemara gives these attributes of the Kohen Gadol, what the Gemara is talking about is simply trying somehow to paint the picture of the Kohen Gadol. What would he look like if you saw him? And if you saw him, these are the things you would see. You would notice his power, you would notice his personality, you would notice his wisdom, and you would notice his wealth. Those are the things you would see. It's interesting also, you can try this with anybody. Take a list of great world leaders. Stalin and Churchill and Napoleon and Truman, and you go right through them and ask people to tell you how tall they were, and then find out how tall they really were, and you'll find invariably that people estimate their height as taller than they are. And that's why, in fact, I understand when Napoleon used to have paintings and things made of him, he used to want height to be brought out in the painting, although he was a short person. The leadership, if it's correct leadership, if it's powerful leadership, creates a picture of height and stature even when it's not there. If the leader is taka, a leader, you see him as someone taller than he is. It's a very funny thing, it's a very strange thing that you can look at. It's amazing even when you see one of these people in the flesh. You know, you read about Kissinger and you see photographs about Kissinger. When Kissinger walks past you, you're amazed at how insignificant he looks. He's a short, fat little Jew walking down the road. So, and that's not the kind of impression you have of him. You have the impression of this tall guy, full of personality and suave and smooth. He's not like that at all. He's a little Lithuanian, he's a German, he's whatever it is. Walking down the road, you wouldn't turn around and look at him a second time if you saw him. But leadership does create that impression of gedulah. So contrary-wise, to create the impression of gedulah, of leadership, the Medrash brings pictorial images of what a gadol should look like to you. When you imagine a gadol, you should see him as powerful, full of personality, wealthy and wise. Comes the question, why does the Medrash do that? Why does the Braisa do that? And why doesn't the Gemara tell us really what are the qualifications of the gadol? And here we have the answer to the question with which we started. How do you measure a gadol? How do you measure quality? You can't. That's the answer. There's no way you can measure it at all. Quality is immeasurable. That's what quality is. If it's measurable, it's quantity. You can measure how much wine there is in a glass, but how are you going to measure how good the glass is? You can ask somebody to taste it, and if he's an expert, he'll say it's good. And if you trust him because he's an expert, you'll also say it's good. But that's the only way you can measure quality. There's no other way of measuring what kind of quality it is. So they try and make formulas, and they try and do this, and they try and do that, methods of testing, but there's no way that you really can. Likewise with gedulah of people, when you're talking about the greatness of people, there's no way that greatness can be measured. Greatness is qualitative and it cannot be measured. And this is something which goes against the grain of our quantitative society. We don't like things you can't measure. So we have a way of overcoming it. We label people, we put them into little boxes and things. He's a faucet, he's a snake, he's a this, he's a that. Everybody's a something that labels him and gives him dimensions. And that's the way we try and overcome the quality, but it doesn't work. It's absolutely non-workable. So we resort to other things. We start measuring the quantity. We start measuring how many mitzvahs he does, and how long he takes over his davening, and how much tzedakah he gives, and these are the things we start using. Again, quantitative things to try and measure the quality of the person. But that's not what the Gemara uses. The Gemara faces the same problem we do. How do we describe the greatness of a Kohen? How do we describe the sense of his own greatness? Says the Medrash, says the Gemara, you can't. All I can do is paint a picture as to what kind of image you should convey. You should convey an image of power and superiority and independence and so on and so forth. And in fact, the Rambam paskens that although this is theoretically required, that the Kohen Gadol should have these qualities, if he doesn't, it's not serious. So you see from there that these aren't the essential qualities of the Kohen Gadol. The essential qualities of the Kohen Gadol is what this represents, not what this is itself. Now, I'm not going to talk tonight about really what qualitative gedulah is, what qualitative greatness is. There are two kinds of greatness. There's relative greatness and absolute greatness. And we see that from a statement of the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, where the Gemara says that Yiftach bedoro kishmuel bedoro. The Gemara says that Yiftach in his generation is as great as Shmuel in his generation, although if you put Yiftach and Shmuel together, obviously Shmuel is by far the greater one. So what the Medrash is saying basically is that absolute greatness is not necessarily the only yardstick of greatness. There are two measures of greatness. You've got to measure a person relative to his own society, and you've got to measure a person in absolute terms. You've got the same concept with Noach, if you remember. Ish tzadik tamim haya bedoro. Ish, however the wording goes, the bedorato. How's it going?
Bedorato.
That he was a tzadik in his generation. You've got a machlokes rav and Shmuel over there as to whether that's to his credit or to his discredit. Do we say in his generation he was a tzadik, but in Avraham Avinu's generation he would be a nobody? Or even in his generation he was a tzadik? But there you see also the concept of relative greatness. Lo kam bi Yisrael kemoshe od Navi, that's absolute. Right? In absolute terms, there was nobody like Moshe. But for each generation, there were people as great as Moshe. For the generation. So there are clearly two kinds of quality and two kinds of greatness.
So relatively, you can measure it.
Oh, so now comes the question, can you measure relative greatness? That's the next thing we've got to look at. The one thing is for sure, absolute greatness you can't measure. And you're not meant to measure, and there's no reason to measure it, and that's for the Ribbono Shel Olam to measure. And that in fact is the understanding of the Gemara that you might remember, where Rabbi Meir had some trouble from some balabatim of his. The committee was giving him a rough time. So he decided he would use his powers to get rid of the committee. But since he wasn't a politician, he couldn't get them outvoted. So he decided to kill them instead. And the method he was going to use to kill them was to pray that they should die, which he was quite sure would work. And his daughter Brulia was very upset, and his daughter said, you have no right to do that, you're judging that they are Rishoyim. And it's not so. It says Yitamu Chata'im min ha'aretz, sins will disappear from the world, not sinners. Nobody has the right to decide to make a decision as to whether a particular person is a tzaddik or a rasha. That you can't say, but you can say whether his actions are the actions of the tzaddik or the actions of a rasha. You can judge actions, and that's the whole concept of Jewish law. The Beis Din will never decide on a person. The Beis Din will only decide on the actions. That's one of the reasons why a woman can't be a witness, because a woman judges people, not actions. And the Beis Din is not permitted to go into a judgment of the people. If a woman thinks the guy is a rotter, she'll see his actions in a bad light, and she'll be right to see them in that light if you're judging the man. But we're not judging the man, we're judging his actions. That's why a man has the brutality to report the actions as they are, without any kind of interpretation of the greatness or baseness of the person concerned, whom you're not permitted to judge. So quality is something you only feel, it's not something you judge. It's not something you can define, and it's not something you can measure. In fact, what is quality? If you look at the Gemara about Odom Arishim, says Rabbi Elazar, Adam Arishim min ha'aretz hat l'rakia, it was from the ground to the sky. What's the Gemara trying to say? It was as tall as from the ground to the sky, it's not possible. What's it trying to say? What's the concept of the heavens? Infinite. And what's the Lisofa olam v'yad sofor, from one end of the world to the other, the world's round. How could it have been from one end of the world to the other? The concept of roundness is infiniteness, it doesn't end. That's the concept of godless, of greatness. It's infinite, it's immeasurable, it's never ending. If you can measure it, it's not great. That you can know for sure. And it's something we hate to admit, and we'll do all we can to pull down greatness onto a level of something measurable so that we can define it. What about relative greatness? What one can decide is whether a person is suitable to be a Kohen Gadol. You can't decide whether he's a tzaddik or not. You can't decide whether he's a saint or he's not a saint. All you can say is this man has the basic requirements for kahuna. He's born from a father who's a Kohen. He's not a halal. They've done nothing wrong in the family. Basically everything's okay. He's got Yerushamayim as far as we know. He keeps halacha. He keeps the Torah. As far as we can tell from his actions, the man is qualified to be a Kohen. Furthermore, he seems suitable to be a leader of Kohanim. He seems suitable to be the man to take over the kahuna altogether. So we can decide that we want to appoint him as a leader. That we can do. But now comes the next question of relative greatness. This is measurable. It's measurable in terms of simply comparing. Does he know more than I do? If he does, he's wiser than I am. Is he wealthier than I am? Then he's wealthier than I am. Relative greatness is easier because it's easy to measure, because you simply have to measure it in terms of your own greatness. And provided in so doing you don't lose sight of the absolute greatness of the person, it's alright. The tendency is, though, when measuring relative greatness, to pull him down to that, to see his total greatness in terms of his relative greatness. It's not so. What happens now about, let's look at it slightly differently. I've mentioned to you often the dispute which exists in all offices of leadership, in rabbonis, in teaching, in national leadership and international leadership. The conflict between a casual leadership and an aloof leadership. So the age-old conflict, you go right through history and you'll find were those kings that were kings of the people and those that were aloof. And it was Beshito, it wasn't just their personality. Each one had a Shito, each one had a theory and had an approach that was the way leadership should be run. And if you go through Rabbonis, you'll find the same thing. As you'll find those Rabbonim who went out of their way to be part of the people and those Rabbonim who went out of their way to be separate from the people. What is it all about? And another problem, what is the concept of a kehillah outgrowing a rov? Is that possible? That they appoint a rov, and the rov takes them to a certain height, and they carry on growing and the rov stays behind. That's another problem that you find in the history of Jewish communities. We see from this Gemara that it's not possible. Absolute greatness, since it can't be measured, is not a requirement for leadership. Since we don't know who's great or not, there's no way we can use that as a basis for choosing a man for leadership. All you can say is he has the basic qualifications and he seems to be suitable for leadership. What is important is relative greatness. He has to be greater than the people he's leading. But now you have something which is contrary to any other theory of greatness or any other theory of leadership in politics or in history, I think. That is where the Gemara says, and what happens if he isn't? Says the Gemara, then you make him. Relative greatness is easy because you can do it by two ways, as we said last night. Except it's the opposite of last night. If you feel if the community is outgrowing the rov, depress the community. But it's only relative greatness which is important. So what happens with a Kohen Gadol, let's say for example, who isn't wealthy enough? He's got the other Kohanim are wealthier than him. Use Marx's system, take the wealth away from the rich ones and give it to the poor Kohen until he's wealthier than them. Most take this as being as well, this din which I've just mentioned now, that the other Kohanim have to make him wealthy if he's not, as referring only to wealth. But it's not the mashmos of the Gemara, because the Gemara says, what does Gedula mean? What does greatness mean? It means those four things. Koach, Noichoch, Monoshe. Minayin Shem Ein Lo. How do you know that if he doesn't have what? One of the four, all of the four. It's much more if he doesn't have gedula, if he's not great for either because he's lacking one or all of them. She'echav ha'kohanim megadlim oso, that the brothers, the kohanim, make him great in whatever he's lacking, be it on the money side, the personality side, the chokmah side, or the koach side. How do you do it? It's simple. On the koach side, on the strength, you give him the authority necessary to handle it. On the personality side, there are all sorts of things one can do to give a person props. If he doesn't have the natural personality, you can train him, you can teach him, you can put him in a circumstance in which he feels at home, that he can use his personality to the best. You can hide the defects of his personality like they do with kings and queens. Simply put them in such a situation that they can use whatever personality they have to the best. Take old Charlie in London there. They were very worried about him. He was going to be a king without personality. So they taught him how to have personality a bit. They educated him properly and they put him into situations which would draw the personality out of him. It's possible to do such a thing when it comes to relative greatness. You can't make a nobody great like that, but relative greatness you can do. chokhmah, wisdom also, teaching, giving them the opportunity to sit and learn. And wealth is the easiest of the lot. You're giving the money. The important thing to understand here in relative greatness is really the following. Here again, a community's tendency is to denigrate its role or its leaders. You see this throughout the Western world today. The leadership of the community is always one which is denigrated. The reason for that we won't go into, but that's as crazy as if you would see a tree, you'd see one of the branches of the tree taking an axe and chopping the trunk off. Why? Because the trunk gets first bite at the water, and the trunk gets the most water, and the trunk's the fattest, look how fat the trunk is and how thin we are. Let's get rid of the trunk. It's as meshuggah. A community has to understand that if it has a leader, we're talking about where it's proper leadership, not play leadership, their entire growth is dependent on that leadership, whether it's political leadership, whether it's academic leadership, whether it's religious leadership. It makes absolutely no difference. If one's talking of leadership, what leadership is the source of growth, is the spring from which it comes. If the spring is there to start with, there's no way that can disappear. Because then, if you want to say that that disappears, you're judging absolute value. If you want to say that we appointed a rov or we appointed a prime minister and he was good at that time, but he's no longer great enough, not suitable enough, great enough, we've outstripped him, that's impossible. You can't outstrip your leaders, because your whole nourishment comes from them. An individual can outstrip his leader, and that's a different problem altogether. But a community's entire nourishment comes from its leadership, and it can't outstrip its leadership. So what can you say then? Simply relative greatness. We have become, he's still as great as he was, but we have become greater than him, and you have to build him up. And this comes on a little bit to the thing that we discussed once, the concept of aura, altogether with the subject of Kohanim, where it talks about the Kohuna altogether, the necessity to make quality effective. And here you see the relationship between relative quality and absolute quality. If you'll tell me that there's a man in Johannesburg who has a flat in Hillbrow, nobody's ever heard of him, nobody ever knows of him, but he's a tzaddik. Absolute tzaddik. All I can say is, maybe. I don't know. I can't judge. If you'll tell me that there's somebody who's not a tzaddik at all, he's a rosha, he's a wicked guy, but he's a leader, he's got things established, and he established schools and institutions, and he's sending people off to yeshiva. Again, I can say whether he's a tzaddik or a rosha, maybe, I can't judge. That's nothing that can be judged. But at least he's somebody effective, he's somebody effectual. We can have a man who is incredibly high in terms of absolute stature and useless to society. And you can have a man who is useful to society and not so high in absolute stature. Hence the Gemara that Yiftach Bedorah Kishmur Bedorah. You have Shmuel and Yiftach. Yiftach is less of a tzaddik than Shmuel, but far more useful to the generation of Yiftach than Shmuel would be in such a generation. One can have such a thing. What one has to realize here really in the whole thing is relative greatness is part of the whole world of action set up. Remember we mentioned the two worlds in which a human being is constantly living, the world of values and the world of action. The world of values is the way things really are and the way things really should be. And the world of action is lemaisa, doing, achieving. The same as it doesn't help to think you're rich if you're not rich, it doesn't help to think you're great if you're not great. That's in the world of action. In the world of the Ribbono Shel Olam, who knows what goes on? We have no entry into that world. One doesn't know. It's the private, intimate world between each individual and his God. And nobody else can penetrate into that world. That's the area of greatness that cannot be judged and that cannot be penetrated. My area of values, my relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam, nobody can possibly know about. It doesn't express itself, really, and it can't be penetrated by an outsider. But it's important that at the same time one's living in a world of action, one's living in a world of achievement. It's interesting that there's a new theory that started developing in the mid-60s, that the concept is not new, but the relationship of it to a biological status is new. The theory is that the brain is divided into two, the left hand side and the right hand side, and the one controls what they call, I'm going to tell you what they call it, because from what they're saying it's clear. The left hand side controls quantity and the right hand side controls quality. And there were two doctors, two neurosurgeons, who did the following experiment in the mid-60s, a fellow called Bogan and a fellow called Sperry. They were treating epileptics, and they developed a system of treating it by cutting the what's that called, between the two, the corpus callosum, between the two, the left hand and the right hand side. Bogan did the operation, and Sperry did experiments for a long time on the people that they did this. The corpus callosum is the part of the brain which connects the left hand side and the right hand side. So Sperry worked out that while Bogan was busy cutting this corpus callosum to treat the epileptics, he worked out that if their other theory is right, that the right hand side and the left hand side of the brain are different in terms of the emotional and rational, the quantity and quality, then these products should be very interesting people to examine. Sperry examined them thoroughly and found that there was hardly any difference between them and other people. It had very little effect on their behavior. There was one important area where it did, and this is where they based the whole theory. If you put an object into the right hand of the patient, and the patient was blindfolded at the time, and you asked him to describe the object he was holding, he could do it. If you put it into the left hand, he couldn't. So they work it out like this. The left hand part of the brain is the quantitative area. To put an object in a person's hand when he's blindfolded and asking him to describe it, he needs the quantitative section of his brain. He's basically going to describe dimensions, size, feeling. It's all very quantitative. He's not asked to describe what he's holding, simply what it feels like. The left hand side of the brain controls the right hand side of the body, therefore it goes directly from the right to the left, and he could describe what he had in his hand. Blindfolded him, put the same object in the left hand, asked him to tell you what it was, he couldn't. But if you then unblindfolded him and showed him a range of objects, no matter how many, he could pick out the one that was in his hand. Now that's a qualitative judgment, that's not a quantitative judgment. It's an intuitive thing. He feels that's the one I was holding. Not because he's measured it, not because he's worked it up. If that theory is right, and I don't think that the medical profession gives much credence to it, I don't know, it doesn't make any difference. If it's right, then it makes a lot of good sense to understand the Pasuk in Mishnah. Because the Pasuk there says that Lev Chacham Bimino, the heart of a wise person is on his right hand side, and the heart of a foolish person is on his left. And medically this has never made any sense before. If this theory is right, it makes absolute sense. That means a wise person uses that right part of his brain, that part of his brain which judges value, which judges quality. And he doesn't necessarily try to quantify everything. A Chacham knows something when he sees it. Taste a glass of wine, he says it's good or it's not good. And don't ask him to tell you why, because he won't think very much of you if you do, nor will he be able to tell you why. If you trust him, you in turn have an intuitive feeling that he's a Chacham, then you accept it, okay, he says it that. And so on. Any question of taste, when it comes to a question of taste which is subjective, and that's where the quality really is, it's not something which is measurable, and it's not something which is definable. It's either yes or no, and you have to be a connoisseur in the thing to understand it and to know. That's it. That's why it's very strange when sort of a guy from the street goes overseas and meets somebody and comes back and says, oh, he's a Talmid Chacham. How do you know a Talmid Chacham? If you're measuring him quantitatively, did you sit down and give him a test? If you're measuring him qualitatively, are you a connoisseur in Talmid Chacham? If you've got the right hand part of your brain is so developed in the skill of differentiating Talmid Chacham, you're judging quality. So in Monoshek it's different. One has to understand all the time what one's doing. Are you weighing up quantity or are you weighing up quality? If you're weighing up quantity, it's not quality. If you're weighing up quality, it's not quantity. They're two different things. So what one sees over here is that even in greatness, which is quality, one can use the right-hand side of the brain for it and the left-hand side of the brain for it. There is such a thing as absolute quality, which cannot be quantified. But there is also such a thing as relative quality. Simply you have to know, is he greater than me in such and such an area? That can be quantified, because that's a simple yes or no answer. Simply work out, does he have or does he know more? That's really quantitative quality, if you would like it. The ultimate in quality is qualitative quality, and it cannot be measured. But there is also such a thing as quantitative quality, which is the quality which is important in normal interpersonal handlings when it comes to leadership. When it comes to anything else, it's absolute quality which is important. When it comes to leadership, then it's important to understand relative quality, and it's important to establish that relative quality. But what's interesting is, this Kohen Pinchas, when he became a Kohen Gadol, he knew this din. He knew that he's entitled to all the money that all the Kohanim had. What did he go around digging pits for? The Kohen isn't allowed to ask for it. If the Kohen asks for it, it puts him in a subservient position. Then there's a certain lack. it's necessary for the Kohen to do everything he can to avoid receiving anything from them, and to do anything he can to avoid becoming dependent on them, and he must go out and dig his ditches. At the same time, it's essential for them, if they want effective leadership, to make quite sure that the relative greatness is there. But for that relative greatness to exist, or for a community to understand, a community of Kohanim, let's say, to understand that they have to elevate their Kohen Gadol themselves to make him relatively great, for that they have to be absolutely great. There's no question of that. For a man to understand the role of leadership and the importance of relative greatness in the leadership, he has to be great himself altogether. Someone's dealing altogether with a community of Kohanim who are particularly great. What Shir Koma is in the absolute sense, what this concept of stature is in the absolute sense, I'm going to try and talk about next week. All I want to show over here is that it's not so simple that one has quantity and quality, but even when one moves into the quality range, one still has quantitative and qualitative, and you can still always do dividing and dividing. And in Kabbalah they've got a lot of that, that all the different spheres, all the different sections are divided into subsections containing parts of one another. Until the very end, you then get the essence itself. And it's not a simple black and white situation. This is quality, this is quantity, materialism, spiritualism. And most things have a bit of each, and it's a question of... it's like the left-hand side and the right-hand side of the brain. You can look at anything using the right-hand side of the brain and the left-hand side of the brain. And when you're looking at it at the left-hand side, it's quantitative. When you're looking at it with the right-hand side, it's intuitive and it's qualitative. And the understanding of the importance of relative quality, and that relative quality is really a quantity, and the most important of all is that absolute quality can't be measured and can hardly be described. But I'm going to try next week to find a way of describing to you the counterpart of quantitative quality. In other words, the real concept of Shir Koma, when we talk about stature, when we talk about a man who's 10 amos high, what are we talking about, that he was 10 amos? I don't know, maybe Moshe was 10 amos, maybe he wasn't. I'll say that's irrelevant, doesn't make much difference to me how tall Moshe was, and therefore the fact that the Gemara says he was 10 amos is what's important about that, is that when you looked at him, you saw a man of 10 amos. That's important to me. What was it in Moshe that gave him the impression of being 10 amos, no matter how high he was? Because sometimes you've got tall people who look short also, you don't. When you think of them, you don't think of them as tall. So one has to understand, what is it that gives that man the stature? What was it that gave Adam HaRishon, before the sin, the stature of infinity? The fact that he was immeasurably great. And that if you looked at him, you felt that you were looking at something that was as tall as the skies and as wide as could be. That you just didn't feel that you were looking at something defined at all. What is it that really constitutes that quality? Obviously, one won't be able to talk about it too much, because when you start talking about too much, you reduce it back to the quantity area. It's something one feels more than one's able to define. But I'll try as far as possible to describe it.